Welcome to Profiles. I'm Annie Corrigan. Our guest today has been called the world's first full-time percussion soloist. She's won a Grammy, she's had a movie made about her, and in 1993, she was awarded the Office of the British Empire. Oh, and she designs jewelry, too. Dame Evelyn Glennie, thank you so much for coming in today.
Pleasure, thank you.
And welcome to Indiana University and Bloomington. Good to have you.
And it certainly is blooming here. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, early spring. It's
beautiful.
Gorgeous in Bloomington. So you've been around the United States before this. You were in Iowa, Maine, Washington. Before that, you were in the UK. You were in Italy and Hungary. All over the place. Your schedule's... it's pretty busy.
It is busy, you know. But having said that, you can't really take anything for granted because you never quite know how a season is going to pan out nowadays. It used to be long ago where you pretty much knew what you were going to do in the next 2 to 3 years. And it may have been that the performances related to the recordings that you made, because there was such a thing as a recording contract and a long-term career-building contract. But, of course, that's all changed. So a lot of the dates that come in are very much last minute. So it's really more of a challenge to work out how the season is actually going to pan out. So, you know, I have been very lucky this season to, I suppose, spend more time in Europe, actually, than in the US. This is the least amount of time that I'll be spending in the US for 2010. It's very, very unusual. But it has opened up the possibilities to visit the Far East and to explore more of mainland Europe.
Mm-hmm. From here, you're doing master classes at Indiana University. Then you're going to Buffalo to premiere a new piece. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I've been a great fan of Eric Kwesen's music, and he's written some fabulous pieces, including a marimba concerto. And as you and I were talking earlier, you mentioned an oboe concerto. And this new piece, which I'll be playing with the Buffalo Philharmonic, conducted by Joanne Folletta, is a piece that's based on Robbie Burns' poetry. And so it's very much close to home. It has a very Celtic feel, Celtic melodies, Celtic rhythms, and just, you know, this great line that he's managed to inject through percussion instruments, which of course can be quite angular, actually. So it's a kind of piece that I feel percussion really needs, the melodic legato-ness, as it were, for us to explore. So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, giving a premiere is always a scary experience, to be honest. But hopefully I feel this piece may gain momentum and have a lot more performances.
This is a premiere, and you're doing master classes here. You've done other performances last month and then earlier in the year. How do you stay strong as a musician? How do you keep your practicing up? How do you learn new pieces as you're on the road traveling so much?
Well, that really is the challenge, because you can't easily move a set of timpani or a marimba or a set of drums or something into a hotel room. You know, a lot of the preparation has to be done, obviously, beforehand. So it could be that you're dealing with music a few months ahead. With a brand new piece of music, I ask for it to be delivered 6 months ahead. I have to say that rarely happens. You know, composers, you know, they can be your best friend or your worst enemy, really, you know, depending on when that music is delivered. But nevertheless, a lot of the preparation is done literally silently. That is, by looking at the music, looking at the score as you're on a plane or waiting at a terminal or something like that. It's just one of those things whereby you have to have the confidence in yourself to know that physically you can deal with the music, but it goes far deeper than that. So a lot of the thinking process is about the musical direction, you know, the actual interpretation. You know, I think that as we try to translate something, that's more the mechanics of playing the instrument, but the interpretation is something that you can deal with as you're on a train or a plane. But nevertheless, you know, any time I can get with an instrument is pretty valuable and quite precious. And that's just the challenge that percussionists have, just the logistical aspect.
And it's also, these aren't your instruments. These are instruments that the orchestra has that they're bringing in for you, or instruments that you pick up at schools like Indiana University. That's something that pianists struggle with too, is that I guess they're not really sure what they're going to sit down at to play.
I think that's very true. And I mean, on this tour, I've had different makes of marimbas right across the board. And I think probably, unlike pianos, you know, something like a marimba or vibraphone can vary in height, it can vary in the width of bars and the width between the bars and one thing or another. So it is pretty crucial to you know, use that time to get used to a particular instrument and not panic about it either, you know, knowing that you will be able to handle a situation. But it is actually being pretty protective of the time that you have and not allow that to be eaten in by doing other things or being distracted by other things. So the focus is absolutely crucial. So if you have 20 minutes with an instrument, then truly concentrate for those 20 minutes, you know, and make good use of that time. So the idea of, you know, having a name, having a focus and a direction for the time that you're with the equipment is absolutely important. It's very crucial indeed.
Yeah. This is the Owaisen Concerto that you'll be playing with the Buffalo Symphony coming up after you leave us here in Bloomington. So let's talk a little bit about your journey as a musician. So way back, how did you get started in music?
Well, you know, I was brought up in a farming community in the northeast of Scotland, and it was a very remote community. Each person knew the other. And it was in the days whereby you could leave your doors open, your cars unlocked, you could let the kids out and really travel for miles on their bicycles or let them walk out. And there was no fear, basically. So it meant really that the whole play aspect had a different feel about it, and the trust level as well was very much heightened between the parents and the children and the neighbours and their children, and therefore the exchange of experiences was quite dramatic, actually. And this spilled over to the music making as well. And what really happened was that whenever we had social gatherings, you know, if we had Auntie so-and-so come and visit or neighbours come and visit, it always ended up with a sing-song or, you know, people getting the accordion out or the fiddle out or the kids playing the piano or whatever it may be. That was just part of life, really. It was completely normal. And of course, all the music was Scottish traditional music. And so it wasn't about reading the music. It was about, you know, transferring that music from person to person. So a lot of the music making was done by ear. And when I went to primary school from the age of 5 until 11, we had a general music teacher come in once a week so that all the kids could learn how to read music by the time they left that school. All of us. It was just the norm. And when we went to secondary school from the age of 11, 12 to 16, 17, 18, depending on how far you wanted to go, music continued. Every child had the opportunity to learn a musical instrument free of charge through the school system.
Wow.
Perfectly normal. So a huge body of the youngsters were playing instruments, you know, even if their emphasis may have been in science or sports or languages or drama or whatever it may be, a large proportion of the kids played instruments. So nearly every school had a school orchestra, a band, a concert band, a choir, and all sorts of things like that. And so when I reached the age of 12, or by the time I was 12 years old, I had already been playing the piano for a number of years. Since the age of 8, I had played the clarinet for 1 year. And I was keen to try something else. And I was hugely inspired by seeing the school orchestra play as a new pupil at the school. And I looked around the orchestra and I saw percussion. I thought, oh, well, maybe I could give that a go. There was an excellent peripatetic teacher there already. And a lot of the percussion teachers actually at the schools were often self-taught drummers. And but this particular teacher came through the army system and he was just a super musician, you know, who happened to teach percussion. And he really gave us a terrific grounding on tuned percussion, and bear in mind, we only had a 3-octave xylophone, but it isn't really the fancy tools that you have, it's what you can do with those tools. He gave us a great grounding on snare drum, on drum set, and on the auxiliary instruments, and then we had 2 hand-tuned timpani. And again, this was just the basics on timpani. So he did not allow anyone to specialise. So the basics on all of those instruments were very much addressed. We did not have any tutor books or study books for percussion or any solo pieces for percussion. Everything was generated from the violin repertoire, piano repertoire, flute repertoire, etc., etc. And all the exercises and improvisations that we did stemmed from those types of pieces. So all the time we were dealing with pieces of music. We all had the opportunity to play little solos at the school concerts and the community concerts and all sorts of settings like that. And this kind of snowballed to taking part in national orchestras, or regional, then national orchestras, and then international events. And, you know, by the time I left school at the age of 16 and started auditioning for music colleges and institutions, I assumed the world was full of solo percussionists because it was so normal for us to play little solos, mm-hmm. you know. So this whole mindset was pretty unbelievable, actually, because you just assumed everything was out there already. And when I became a full-time student in London, I discovered that, well, actually, where is the repertoire? Where are the solo players? I don't see any of them. Why aren't I getting this at the institution? And it was a complete flip of the coin that was happening, you know. And then I very, very quickly realised, my God, you know, if I want to do this and sustain any kind of reasonable career, I had to very quickly get some repertoire written, get together with the composers and construct my own kind of programs and really get percussion out there to the general public. So that was really the main challenge.
Yeah, you were very much a trailblazer in this. To say that you were the first full-time percussionist, you sort of started this on your own. So it was really working with composers to get pieces written. And then how else did you get yourself out there to let people know, hey, I'm here, hire me?
Well, you know, it was in the days whereby as a student at somewhere like the Royal Academy of Music, it was quite difficult to play outside of the academy. We almost had to tell little white lies, you know, to say, oh, not feeling well today, you know, and meanwhile you were off somewhere playing. But it was the only way I could really get that experience. I was fortunate because I had a couple of television documentaries, profile documentaries made, and that helped. But nevertheless, I really, as far as the repertoire was concerned, I basically bought the British Music Yearbook, and there it lists, you know, so many composers and venues and all sorts of things. So I basically wrote to about 200 composers asking if they would write pieces of music. What I hadn't realised was that they needed to be paid. So many of them wrote back, actually. And this was in the days when, you know, you had to almost handwrite your letters or get a typewriter, you know, and do this. So I basically wrote a number of letters, received a number of replies, some of them saying, ooh, actually intriguing, yes, I'll write a 2-3-4 minute piece. Other people said yes, and this is my commission fee, and others simply declined. So I ended up actually with a whole body of short pieces that were really useful for radio performances, for workshops, for little demonstrations for children, little encore pieces, pieces that I could spice a recital with. And this was the beginning, really, just the first step of working with the composers and seeing how this whole process works, actually. And then gradually, you know, it stemmed to larger scale pieces and more in-depth types of projects and more prominent performances. I gave a lot of concerts to corporate companies, you know, so after dinner type of performances. And of course, to have a percussionist was completely unusual for them. They would normally have a singer, possibly a violinist, possibly a pianist, but some of them dared to have, you know, this kind of percussion player. And it was fantastic because, of course, it was so unusual. And it was a fantastic platform for me to just experiment with the repertoire, to get to know a lot of the corporate people, actually. So it was delving into a whole world that actually now I'm sort of drawn back into through the motivational speaking. So it's almost come full circle in a way. But yeah, it's been a pretty interesting journey.
And you're expanding the repertoire now by writing music yourself. You're a composer. And as you said, you're a motivational speaker too. So tell me a little bit about the composing.
Well, I see myself as a composer with a little C as far as the concert platform is concerned. But most of my compositions are to do with the media. By that, I mean television, radio, writing for films, that type of thing. So it's all related to something that's visual. So at the moment, I'm working on a low-budget film called Golf in the Kingdom, which is an American film, and it's about the psychology of golf playing based in Scotland. So what they're looking for are very much organic sounds, you know, and sounds that whereby you see movement and you relate that to sound. So, of course, they're very interested in my whole journey of creating sound. You know, that type of composition is very different to the concert platform. And it's fantastic because I can then use a lot of the sounds that I have available from the instrument collection at home. And that's pretty large. So, you know, I'm able to use things that I perhaps wouldn't ordinarily use on the concert platform. So it's, for me, it's an umbrella. And I mean, the word music is such a, you know, it's huge. So this is an avenue, as it were, that that I very much like to explore.
Well, this is a perfect time to play one of the pieces that you wrote. You wrote Thunder Caves. It's an improvisation for percussion. So tell me a little bit about this. How do you write out an improvisation, first of all?
Well, you don't write it out, basically. The whole idea of Thunder Caves, and it's from a CD called Shadow Behind the Iron Sun. It's a completely improvised CD. And what I really wanted to do, having made a number of CDs featuring other people's music, there was one of the early CDs where I had put little sorbets, or improvised sorbets really, of just a few seconds or a minute or a couple of minutes. And I wanted to extend that idea and make a whole improvised CD. And the concept was very, very simple indeed. Just simply fill the studio with many, many different types of instruments and objects. And I would literally play what I felt at that moment. So I simply asked the engineer to keep the mics on, and that was it. You know, it's just a very simple process. So that's exactly what I did, but I wanted it to be produced much more in a pop way and not a classical CD. So I got a wonderful producer in, Michael Brower, who had never even seen a marimba before, and indeed many of the objects that were in the studio. We had never met before, and we had no idea whether the chemistry would work or what would happen. As it happened, it was just a fantastic collaboration, one of those collaborations that almost happened once in a lifetime, to be honest. By the end of it, we were like brother and sister, really. We got on so well. And he completely understood where I was coming from. We had to feed, each day we had to feed what we were doing down the phone line to BMG, you know, in New York, so that they could at least see that we were doing something. And because this whole idea of creating something improvised was so alien to them, because normally they were used to featuring a composer or something, or an actual performer playing written music, so that they knew exactly what they were going to get. And so this is what happened, and it was a fantastic experience and a very liberating experience as well. And from that, it gave me the confidence to give completely improvised concerts, mainly in collaboration with other people. And the type of collaboration that I've really worked on is with Fred Frith, the fantastic guitarist. And so we've, you know, I think our next concert is in England, but we've performed all over the world together, really.
Oh, that's fantastic. Mm. Let's take a listen. This is Thunder Caves. Music written there by Evelyn Glennie. That was Thunder Caves, improvisation for percussion. You were performing there with David Motion, so collaborating with him on that performance. And that entire CD, as you said, Shadow Behind the Iron Sun, was an entirely improvised CD. So we have another selection coming up later in the hour that's from a piece that was written for you. So that's an exciting new thing to talk about.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net.
For listeners who don't know, you've been profoundly deaf since the age of 12. And so it might be strange for some people to think this world-famous professional musician can't hear. So let's talk about that a little bit. When did you start losing your hearing, and how did that affect you as a young woman?
Well, basically, I began losing my hearing from the age of 8. This was a very slow process, and I was having real problems with my ears before that. But we didn't obviously realize that to lose your hearing, you know, at such a young age was actually happening. However, it was becoming a problem. Schoolwork was being affected. Conversation was being affected. Music at that time, from about the age of 8 to 12, was not so affected because I was still very much dealing with the mechanics of playing, and I was playing the piano. But I was finding that a lot of my time was spent indoors because it was too painful to go outdoors. You know, the wind, the cold weather, that sort of thing was really affecting the ears. So by the time I went to secondary school at the age of 12, I was really struggling, actually, with just basic conversation. I then was fitted out with hearing aids and phonic ears for classroom work so that the teacher, I could basically pick the teacher up as he or she was able to walk around the classroom so that it wasn't really affecting the other pupils. But it was really in the teenage years where music was now becoming a challenge, because I assumed that in order to hear, you needed things to be louder. And what the hearing aids did was, of course, boost the sound, but it didn't give you any clarity. So as a percussion player and as a player playing in the school orchestra and being in a school environment, you had an awful lot of different frequencies, different attacks, different dynamics to deal with. And this was hugely tiring, very frustrating indeed. And sometimes when I got home, I'd just take the hearing aids off, throw them on the bed, and be in a world of silence almost. But what I did discover was actually when that happened, all the other senses became razor sharp. And my hearing skills actually also became much more profound. And I was discovering that actually, without feeding the sound through the ear, I was inadvertently feeding the sound through the body. So the body almost became a huge ear. And so everything was being distributed to a bigger mass, as it were. And so when I got back to school, my percussion teacher, who was extremely open-minded and patient, you know, discovered that actually when I was wearing the hearing aids, I was becoming extremely frustrated and not angry as such, but just simply not, it wasn't me, you know. Things were coming through in my personality that actually weren't to do with me. And I found that I wasn't really enjoying what I was doing, and I was banging everything. You know, I was just banging everything to be heard, you know, for me to hear myself. And I knew that this wasn't what was inside of me as a musician. So the two were really fighting each other. But then when I was taking the hearing aids off, I became much more sensitive towards the sense of touch, really. Because, again, I was feeling everything through the body. And so together we were beginning to feel the differences between one pitch and another pitch, one interval and another interval, and really honing in on that. So in my mid-teens, whenever I was playing, it was usually without the hearing aids, but all other times the hearing aids were in. And this was just a revelation, really. And even to this day, you know, you can't say, well, this is how you hear, because every instrument is different, every hall is different, every piece of music is different, every mallet you use is different, etc., etc. But it was a kind of, you could see the light at the end of the tunnel, where the enjoyment of music and getting back on that journey of curiosity and discovery happened again. And the whole idea of sharing music was important. And there was far less of this self-centeredness, where through needing to hear yourself, you know, where you're charging forward without any kind of realization as to what was going on elsewhere, even although you knew that stuff was happening. And, you know, it was a funny period, really. But it was also, I found when I was at my happiest, it was when I was playing by myself. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to be a solo player. It was because I could actually be in control of what I was doing myself. So it sounds terribly selfish, but of course the big challenges are when you are playing with an orchestra, even in a concerto format. And it's why I position my instruments at an angle, usually a 90-degree angle to the audience, so that I can see about three-quarters of the orchestra. But the conductor can also see me, and that's equally important because, of course, they still need the experience of performing with a solo percussionist to know how we breathe and how we strike and the different sound colours that we have. And very often conductors will know, you know, how to read the rhythm of a percussion part, but they won't necessarily know the actual direction of the sound colour. You know what I mean? Where suddenly you're striking a wood block and next minute it's a cymbal, the next minute it's a bass drum, the next minute it's a timpani and so on and so forth. So they'll see the rhythm of all of that, but not necessarily understand the colours. And it's often the colours that can then affect the rhythm. And so it's a sort of interesting process, really. But the whole aspect has been a very interesting journey. But it has allowed people to understand that, my God, you know, you don't have to hear through the ear only in order to be a musician. It's a lot more than that, you know. And I think a great example of that, of course, is Beethoven. You know, his greatest music often was written after he began losing his hearing. But of course, he did not have the mod cons that we have now. And even since I was a youngster, the technology for hearing impaired people has advanced to such an incredible degree. I mean, unbelievable. And for me, I think it's important to explore that. Although at my age, I would find it very daunting to change my situation so dramatically where I wouldn't be sure whether I'd actually hear better, considering my whole profession is about sound, and I'm not sure if I can take that step.
Well, and people have seen you perform without your shoes. There are, you know, videos of this where you take your shoes off so that you perform barefoot and you can feel the music better throughout your entire body. You're talking about hearing with your body. Explain that a little bit for someone who can hear. I guess we don't necessarily always tap into that.
Well, there's probably less need for you to tap into that. And of course, you know, we live in a world where you can't escape sound. So you're hostage to that, whether you like it or not. You know, we're all hostage to that. I think in my situation, you can distribute it better. You can cut something out much more easily and focus on one particular sound. You know, I remember as a full-time student, we had one percussion room, can you believe? And that was used for teaching and practice. Otherwise, you are out in the corridor. And so sometimes you might have had four or five people in this one room, not much bigger than this studio area that we're in. And so we were extremely close together physically, all playing completely different things. But this was an interesting situation because it meant that to play pianissimo, for example, meanwhile, when all of this other stuff was going on, you really had to have control of your own concentration, your own focus, your own balance, as it were, your own sense of touch. And that was where the sense of touch really, truly came in, and you had to hone in on that. So it was an interesting exercise. And as percussion players, you know, we're used to moving sound. We're used to perhaps having an instrument where we have to walk here and there with the sound, or we're used to one minute playing a marimba over there, the next minute playing a set of drums over here, the next minute playing a multi-set over in that department. And, you know, that's the nature of sometimes the setups that we have. So we are used to one minute feeling the brass from the violin side and the next minute feeling the brass from the cello side. And that's the way it is. But sometimes we become too comfortable with the kind of kind of listening direction of the sound. So most violinists sit in the same seat, you know, in the same direction, and that's how they're perceiving the brass or the basses or the clarinets or whatever it is. It's coming all the time from the same direction. They have the same perspective of the sound. Percussion players are much more mobile and open to that. And for me, that's really crucial because I'm continually dealing with moving sound that's constantly swimming throughout my body, and I have to make sense of that.
I'm thinking about the nature of percussion. You have so many instruments that you're responsible for. As you said, it's very physical. You're constantly moving around. I wonder if you can translate this idea of feeling the sound throughout your entire body to a wind instrument, to a string instrument, maybe even to singing.
Well, you can to an extent, but again, it depends on the proximity, it depends on the type of player, the type of music, and so on and so forth. So, you know, if you are, for example, I had the wonderful experience premiering a marimba and violin concerto with orchestra, obviously. And the violinist was right next door to me, standing up, and he was a terrific player as well. And so, you know, we experimented with him being on my right and on my left. You know, and very often, if I possibly can, I like to set my instruments up on the cello side of an orchestra because I feel more of the cellos, and it's a better range for me to feel more than the violins, which is quite high and much more difficult for me to actually hear through the ear as well. And that really is why I position myself as far as I possibly can on the cello side. But this was a great example where I could actually hone in on one player, you know, and obviously I knew his part as well. And, you know, how we were set up meant that clearly we could see each other. And the whole physicality of playing. So someone can give the illusion of creating a sound and not actually create the sound, but I will hear it. Because if there's movement, I'll hear sound. And that's a great, you know, for me, my world is very visual. So, you know, sound is movement, and that's the way it is. So I will react to that and assume that there is sound, you know. So, I mean, the other day, you know, I had the instance of seeing a kettle boil. Now, my kettle at home, you can actually see the water bubble, and you know that a light comes up and you know when it's boiling. And in this instance, you couldn't really see the kettle, but my friend said, well, watch the steam come out and then it'll make a whistling noise. And so I thought, well, how much steam do I need to see before I know that the kettle has boiled? You know, is it a lot? Is it not a lot? And so on. So again, you know, it's familiarizing yourself with a situation so that you translate that visual element into sound. So I'm not going to depend on the whistle sound, but I will depend on the steam. But I need to know how much steam is going to come out of that kettle. So if it's just a kind of little wisp of steam, then for me, that has a certain sound to it. If it's a lot more steam at a certain velocity, that has another sound to it. And it goes on and on and on like that.
When you perform with these orchestras, you perform often as a soloist in front of the orchestra. Do you have any desire to go to the back and play in the percussion section as part of the orchestra?
No.
No?
Not at all. Unless it would be timpani. I would love to be a timpanist in an orchestra, but I have no desire at all. You know, I realize the art of orchestral playing truly is an art, and it's a hugely, I think, stressful situation as well. It's not so much the amount that you have to do, but it truly is choosing those colors, choosing the instruments, and being completely and utterly at one with, you know, 80, 90, 100 players. And, you know, it truly, truly is something that very often looks easy to do, but actually is not. So I've got a lot of admiration for orchestral players. But no, I have absolutely no desire at all to do that. So I feel, you know, as far as choosing the kind of career path that I've had, I still feel right about that.
Well, let's take a listen to another piece of music here. You're performing this piece that was written for you. It was written by Erki Sventure.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm getting that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Close. Okay, good.
Estonian composer.
Yes, Estonian. This is from his Symphony No. 4 called Magma. We're going to hear the second movement. Talk about the process of working with him as he wrote this piece for you.
Well, he's a very dynamic composer, and I remember performing in Tallinn in Estonia, and I was playing really one of the most well-known percussion concertos called Veni, Veni, Emmanuel by James McMillan. And Erkki Sventur came along to the performance and he introduced himself. He gave some of his pieces to me that he had already written for percussion. I had a look at those. I was really intrigued by them. And we kept in contact and I asked if he would be interested in writing a concerto. He was very, very interested in that. And so as time went by, he said, you know, I'm just seeing this huge piece of music. And he decided that he would like to write a symphony, but for solo percussion and orchestra, which he called Magma. And it really is, you know, you feel this kind of weight of the piece. It's a huge structure. And I've played it several times now and recorded it. And in fact, the next performance of it is in the US with the National Symphony Orchestra in Washington, D.C. in June. So, you know, I just really like his writing because he has this balance between, I mean, he seems to have his own voice, obviously, but this balance of tapping into the period when he was growing up, which was the 60s, you know, so he's not frightened to feature a drum set within the setup. You know, he has this kind of rhythmic pool, really, that's very infectious as well, but a whole sound world that takes you into, you know, all the extremes of frequencies and attacks and really gets this terrific sound world from the orchestra as well. I very, very much like him, and certainly his solo works are worth delving into.
Well, let's take a listen. This is the second movement from Symphony No. 4, Magma, by Erkki Sventur. Music by Erkki Sventur. We heard the second movement of this. It's really a single movement work, Symphony No. 4, called Magma, performed by our guest today on Profiles, Evelyn Glennie. Thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So you're here at Indiana University to teach, but then after you leave us, what do we have to look forward to on your schedule? What are your upcoming projects?
Well, heavens, basically, I finished the U.S. with Eric Iwasen's piece, and then I work on this film called Golf in the Kingdom, and so that really has to be completed within the next month and a half. Meanwhile, I have performances to give in Zurich, Switzerland, and I give a lot of recitals with piano, and that's always interesting because they have a very different feel than giving recitals without piano, and obviously the repertoire is different, but you can combine pieces that don't use piano along with the piano pieces. So it's a good combination. And we also head over to Abu Dhabi as well, and I'm collaborating with a wonderful DJ called DJ Yoda, who's really pushing his boundaries as far as what he does sound-wise and visually. And, you know, a lot of people who sort of reach the age of 40 or so and who have really created a strong career doing what they do are often looking for other things to do, other collaborations, other challenges. And this is a situation that we have, you know, where DJ Yoda has, you know, almost done all he can do within the club scene and is really eager to express himself through what he does. For example, taking something melodic, you know, his whole world is based on rhythm and driving that energy through people. But he wants to do this by exploring melody, you know. So we're working together and we have performances in Norway and the UK. The performances with Fred Frith continue, of course, and of course they're completely different types of performances. You know, our next one is a situation where we're performing in a fairly modern church in the UK, and everybody, the whole audience, can you imagine, will be lying down on their backs, you know, on cushions, and they'll literally be looking up at the spectacular ceiling, and we will be improvising where some instruments will be on a balcony, some will be down on the floor level. So, you know, this is going to be a really interesting experience for all concerned. And again, it's something just a wee bit different for us to deal with. I'm also working on a choir and percussion project and getting repertoire up for that. And for the past 2-3 years or so, I've been in the process of commissioning pieces that feature duo concertos. And of course, the commission process is much more challenging nowadays because of the financial climate that we're all experiencing. But, you know, I've already had an oboe and percussion concerto, violin, marimba percussion concerto, piano and percussion concerto. Christian Lindberg, the wonderful trombonist, is writing a trombone and percussion concerto. I have William Bolcom writing a voice and percussion concerto, and so on and so forth. So, you know, this is a long-term project, of course, you know, and something that I'd like to continue really forevermore, because it can go on and on and on. But, you know, so far, it's progressed pretty well.
Wow, there's a lot going on. Yeah. All great stuff. Let's talk a little bit about the music climate these days. So it's a little tumultuous. Mm-hmm. We have people, orchestras are in some financial troubles. Tuition at music schools like Indiana University, unfortunately, mm-hmm. tuition is going up. Some say interest is going down. As someone who has her toes in many different areas of music, not just classical music, but all music, mm-hmm. how do you see it? Where are we as Western art musicians today?
Well, it's a big question, and I'm not sure if I can really answer that very clearly. But I do know we can't take anything for granted. We have always got to reinvent. You know, those are the facts, and that will always have to happen. You know, the excitement that audiences felt and the participation that they felt during the times of Liszt and Paganini, where they were engrossed in, you know, the technical aspect and the musical aspect. The two went together, really. But of course, nowadays, you know, our whole social world is different, and our entertainment can happen within the privacy of our own four walls. And there's a huge amount of entertainment to choose from as well. It can be much more an isolated experience. You know, we're quite happy being entertained on our own. You know, it isn't such a shared experience anymore. And so for people to get out of their comfy chair and out of their home environment, they've really got to make that effort and see something quite special, actually. So I think as far as the orchestral scene, we have to really see each performance as an event and not just another concert, you know, that's in that subscription series. We've really got to keep reinventing. And I think that we've got a terrific opportunity to get young music directors in who are interested in bringing composers from different backgrounds, you know, people who are dealing with perhaps electronics or folk music. Or, I mean, you think of the name of Bella Fleck, for example, or Edgar Meyer, who are just fantastic examples of musicians who delve into many different avenues, who collaborate with many different types of people, and who can bring this kind of excitement and curiosity and kind of the audience step on this journey that is always memorable. And, you know, you can then program Beethoven or Tchaikovsky or Sibelius or something alongside that. And so that the Beethovens become really exciting again. You know, it's when we're kind of being fed too much of the same diet. I think we have a problem and we're losing people, actually. So I think the type of programming and how it's programmed, the kind of before and after events leading up to that is pretty important to address as well. So we've got to feel the vibe of the event as soon as we walk into an environment, actually. So it does mean a lot more thought and in a way a lot more work as far as visiting people like myself, you know, but we're prepared to do that and we have to do it, actually. It's getting this balance sorted out.
Then the flip side of this is the music lovers out there, people who tend to go to concerts, perhaps want their Beethoven, they want their Mozart. Some people say that new music, 21st century, 20th century music is a little alienating. So what would you say to the people who just aren't interested in that? I don't want that. I'll stick to the 18th and 19th century music. Thank you very much.
Well, you see, our whole problem has been about categorization. You know, we're determined to use classical, even for today's composers. We're determined to categorize everything, thinking it's going to make it easier for people to digest and understand and you know, get a grip on what they're actually going to see. And of course, it's too early to categorize the music that's written today. You know, it hasn't had a chance to breathe yet. It's a little bit like dealing with the senses and why sometimes, you know, the frustration has come through in talking about my hearing situation, because you just assume that all sound is fed through the ear, and it goes on and on. So if you cover your ears, you can no longer hear, and that's what all deaf people experience. Or you shut your eyes, and that's what blind people experience. And so you go to a classical concert, and so you're going to get, you know, 20th century and Beethoven, and that's a classical concert because you see an orchestra there. And it's not quite marrying up, and I think that we do, it has created problems, actually. But I would like to see much more conversation, in a way, happen with conductors, with composers who are present there, with the musicians themselves, with soloists, really connecting with our audiences. You know, having pretty regular programs in place to get our young folk into these concert halls as well. You know, we see a lot of empty seats in those halls. And, you know, we can fill those up. We really can. You know, it's fantastic when you discover projects that young people might be doing at school that is related to what an orchestra is doing, that's related to a soloist. But all of this has to be dealt with in advance, you know. And so it's just a little bit more forward thinking, a little bit of planning. We don't need the fancy gadgets. We don't want extra expense as far as that's concerned. We just want better communication.
We're in the year 2010. Where do you see yourself in 2020 as a performer, as a speaker, as a teacher?
Actually, I don't know. You know, if you asked me 10 years ago, I'd probably be very clear as to where I would want to be. But now I don't know. And the reason I say that is because I think the world is moving very quickly at this point. I feel that the reinvention has to happen on a much more regular basis. And I also feel, though, that whatever happens, things will be simplified. So there are obvious long-term things that I would hope to still be involved with, whether as a player or not, but would be the commissioning process. I'd love to obviously continue with that. I'd love to, you know, see a player and see a composer. And if I've already hung the sticks up or something, I'd still like to be involved in that process. And because I know the value of that and the interesting journey that you can really involve yourself with. And I would love for people to be encouraged by that. Obviously, there's the whole construction of instruments themselves. You know, that's a continual thing, obviously. But I'm at the stage where it's important to feed the next generation, where they use what I've done almost as a trampoline for their own situation so that they can push their boundaries further than I can. So it really is also dealing with the importance of music and sound therapy, because the crux, when you really hone in on things, the crux of whether it's domestic challenges or business challenges, it's about listening. It's truly about listening. You know, whether you're dealing with a health service, whether you're dealing with the teaching profession, whether you're dealing with an engineering company, it doesn't matter. The crux of what we all do is about listening. And I don't mean what you hear through the ear. It's about listening to each other and giving each other that chance to be heard. Listening is about watching. It's about the body movements. It's about the patience. It's about, you know, just the teamwork.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Dame Evelyn Glennie, solo percussionist, composer with a lowercase c, motivational speaker, jewelry maker, teacher, visiting masterclass presenter at the Jacobs School of Music, Indiana University. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
You've been listening to Profiles. I'm Annie Corrigan.
The program you just heard was recorded in April of 2010. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.